is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs meeting in hearing room.
This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs meeting in hearing room A on Wednesday, April
13, 1977. Call 701. Our first witness is Willis Davis.
Willis Owen,
Oregon State Firefighters, Local 514.
314.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Willis Owen, and I appear on behalf of the Oregon State Firefighters and as president of Local 314 and the Salem Professional Firefighters. Firefighters are not being accepted under this section of the law without a long legal battle. Our people have proved that the claim is job-related, and it has been our understanding that it was the workman's comp to prove it wasn't job-related. After discussing our problem with workman's comp personnel, it was felt that suggested new language would help. I have with me today manuals for the committee containing firefighters' health problems and research done by several doctors from across the United States who specialize in heart and respiratory disease to discuss our problem in great detail and length. I am offering to loan to the committee if you wish. Today, for a person to be hired as a firefighter, they must pass a physical. The medical profession states tension is a contributor to heart disease, and tension is something every firefighter is under when responding to an alarm. Even today, with self-contained breathing apparatus, the medical profession states that after 25 minutes with one of these units on, in a fire ground operation, some heart cell damage has occurred. This is caused because the masks are not 100% seal-proof. When you encounter smoke, you have carbon monoxide, which does the damage to the heart and respiratory system. We also encounter many plastics, polyesters, and synthetics, which in themselves are okay until they become involved in a fire. Then they become real hazards to the respiratory of the firefighter. Interesting enough, some of these effects don't show up until sometime after the fire. With the growing evidence that smoke spewed from the smokestack and spread over an area of several miles is harmful to the heart and lungs of the healthy as well as sick individuals, it seems ludicrous to think that these same dust and smokes and gases concentrated in a room under fire situation would not be harmful to the heart and lungs of a firefighter. These are a few examples that cause our problem. More in-depth information is available within these manuals. We feel this language added to the present statute would help firefighters to be accepted under the law. If not, it would at least be up to the workman's comp to prove that it didn't. We urge your support of this legislation. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Owens. Earl Noble, Oregon State Firefighters, Local 314.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Earl Noble, 785 18th Street, Northeast, Salem, Oregon. Member of the Salem Professional Firefighter Council, Local 314. I'm here today representing the Oregon State Firefighter Council. I'm also a member of the Oregon AFL-CIO Standing Committee on Workmen's Compensation. Basically, the big problem in the firefighter's heart and lung bill is that the legislative intent of the bill has not been carried out. In 1961, when House Bill 1018 was offered before the legislature and passed, Senator Groener is the only member of the legislature that is still here. I wouldn't want to put words in his mouth, but I think with the discussion with him at that time that he felt that this was the intent of the bill, was to provide that any disease disease of the heart or lungs would be presumed to have arisen in and out of the occupation. This is what the law basically provides, but this has not been the case. In support of the statement that this is or was a legislative intent, I quote from two sources. One, a decision by Judge Douglas L. Hay, deceased, of the Marion County Circuit Court, dated December 18, 1969. The legislature has established presumptively causal connection in certain circumstances between the occupation of firemen and death by coronary circulatory disease. This being the case, no medical evidence is needed unless to establish a causal relation from some unrelated source. Unquote. The second is in a letter from Charles Gill, General Manager of State Accident Insurance Fund, to myself, dated March 18, 1975, in which he states, in reviewing the original legislation and amendments thereto, it is apparent that the legislature intended that such cases could be disputed if evidence indicated factors other than job relationship, unquote. I'm sorry to say that this has not been the attitude of SAFE, and I refer to SAFE only in view of the fact that SAFE is the exclusive carrier of workman's comp insurance for all political subdivisions, and hence all firefighters in the state of Oregon, with the exception of the city of Portland. The reverse procedure has too often been true. The burden of proof has been placed upon the claimant to prove that the disease was caused by the occupation. Over the years, there have been very few claims on a heart claim or a lung problem, respiratory problem, that have had an award made without a battle on it. The city of Astoria and the city of Medford, there were two claims, both of which were disallowed by SAFE. They were disallowed by the hearings officer. They were appealed to the Board of Medical Review, which at that time was in effect, and the Board of Medical Review disallowed the claims. We were able to get an affidavit from the doctors on these two claims that they were not aware of the heart and lung bill, the provisions of it. These two claims went back to the board, and both claims were allowed by the board, whom I am sure has a very clear understanding of the bill. We've had one claim here in Salem, which was purported to be a congenital disease of the heart. Provides that a fireman, upon entering into the occupation of firefighter, shall have a physical examination which produces no evidence of any such disease. This employee did have such an examination. If it was a congenital disease, certainly then the occupation must have aggravated the disease. The awards that have been made, we had one firefighter in Salem who suffered a heart attack while on duty. He was given an award that was about equal to the loss of the big toe. So apparently a heart isn't worth too much to a man. Another claim in Salem, which when taken to the circuit court, the widow was awarded all back claim was later appealed to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled that the Circuit Court did not have jurisdiction. The widow had received her allowances, but the attorney did not get his allowance out of it. Another claim in Salem was filed. The claim was disallowed. The widow, after looking back at the Johnson claim and the years that it, of hassle that it went through, she decided she would rather just drop the thing than go through the same kind of hassle and heartache. We have another claim in the city of Salem pending at the present time. In 1962, this individual filed on the heart and lung section of the law. His doctor stated that his problem was hypertension, and an individual of his age, the only reason that he could see for such hypertension was the stress of the occupation. 14 years later, the man has suffered severe heart damage. He is no longer able to perform his duties as a firefighter. He is filed under the heart and lung law. And again, the claim has been denied. It is presently in the process of awaiting a hearing before a hearings officer of the Workmen's Compensation Board. And I would very much urge this committee to give this bill a due pass recommendation in order that we may place the burden of proof of legislative intent where it properly belongs, upon the insurance carrier to prove that the disease was specifically caused by something outside the occupation, rather than the burden of proof being upon the injured employee to prove that it was caused by the occupation. Incidentally, there are 39 states in the United States today that have a heart and lung bill similar to Oregon's. The only difference is Oregon is the only one that includes a disputable presumption. All of the others, 38 of them, have the wording that it is presumed to have arisen in and out of the occupation. Thank you. If there are any questions,
are there any
questions?
Senator Wires?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The firemen are in an unusual situation regarding their training compared to most employees, where they can be required to, which is part of the job, to stay in physical shape. Is that correct?
This is right, yes.
There's regular exercise that would build up the lungs and the heart muscle to keep it in good shape?
Within some departments, yes, but this is not the basic problem. The basic problem is the atmosphere in which the firefighter works, containing toxic gases, carbon monoxide, the high temperatures, the stress under which one works, and there are studies that will show a very great increase in the heartbeat.
Well, and I don't want to interrupt you, but I listened carefully to your testimony earlier about that, and I studied that some earlier myself, and I'm in complete agreement with you about those risks, and I think we should do something about it. But I wanted to make a comment so you understand my question. I'm in total agreement with you that we should have a heart lung. Is that what you call the law?
Yes.
And but I think should have some bargaining here, too, because when you shift the presumption like this, what you basically do is you pretty much say that automatically that somebody who has one of these problems is going to be covered. It's one of the things that happens when you shift the burden, in my opinion. And that maybe we should... I think that's probably a good idea, too. But I think if we're going to do that, that maybe we ought to try to ask in return an extra high standard of protection of health in other on the part of the firemen. And what I'm getting at partly is there seems to be almost irrebuttable evidence now that people who get their heartbeat up there at least 3 or 4 times a week for 5 or 10 minute period where they're huffing and puffing have less heart disease. Now, that's all things being equal. Then on top of it, those same people with a healthy heart and lungs, if they go in and smoke and get their lungs exposed to these things, they'll probably still have these problems. I'm saying do away with it. And we should compensate. And the other thing is smoking cigarettes. I really would question whether we should put this presumption on and then allow someone to sit in the fire station during the hours when there isn't a fire and smoke Camel non-filter cigarettes one after another, which we know causes emphysema. So I would ask you if an amendment would bother you to say that something along those lines, an exercise program, and that this not cover people who smoke cigarettes.
I can't foresee any problem with including a good exercise program. I think basically right now the firefighters do keep themselves in good physical shape. Through training, many of them have a physical fitness program that they develop upon their own. Certainly, there are none of us that are interested in developing a heart problem. As far as the amendment to exclude the smokers of cigarettes from the coverage, I don't know of any specific evidence to say that the smoking of cigarettes causes a heart problem. Certainly it does contribute to emphysema. This I wouldn't argue with for a minute.
It seems if we're going to really underwrite everybody, every fireman's lungs, that we it would be fair to ask in return that coverage only extend to people who not smoke cigarettes.
I would hate to see it committed to that as a sanction of law.
I think that probably he's on the right track there, but I think we also ought to include that no fireman should be allowed to drink whiskey, beer, or wine. I mean, this is bad, too.
Right.
And nowadays, that's the list that causes...
I was going to say that, but I thought I'd be more discreet.
Firemen may not live longer, but it's sure going to seem like they live longer.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes,
sir. As long as it's now written, would it apply to volunteer firemen?
The law applies to volunteer firemen if the districts or cities which employ volunteer firemen maintain a list of each and every fireman that is on the list. That's works for the department.
Well,
certainly a volunteer fireman is exposed to the same hazards in the atmosphere in which they work as a paid firefighter is.
That's true, but on when they're not acting as firemen, some of them might be working in the garage where there's a lot of carbon monoxide with a boss like Senator Rooner, and they have all kinds of tension.
Well, then this would also be true of the provision which is offered, that the medical evidence would show that it was caused by something specifically unrelated to their occupation as a firefighter.
I'm really bringing this up. It appeared to me that it would be awfully hard to determine whether the lung damage was caused by carbon monoxide in the garage he worked or as he got it at the fire.
The carbon monoxide does not cause as much lung problem as it does heart problem. And the...
Well, either way.
The dangers of the carbon monoxide today are more or less minimized as to what they were 15 years ago when this bill was originally passed. To the new developments in building materials, using cemented polyvinyl chlorides, styrene-based plastics, and this type of thing, which are much harder upon the system than carbon monoxide. I'm not saying that carbon monoxide does not damage the system, but there are so many new building products being used. Not only building products, but the products used in clothing, any number of your synthetics.
What I'd like to know is how many actual days a week does the average fireman spend in a fire station fighting fires? A day and a half, 2 days, and then the rest of the time he's off. And secondly, I'd like to know, do they have any jobs? Like, are they working in garages, or what do they do on their days off? What type of work do they do?
Firefighters, I think, on their days off, do almost any type of work that there is on the market, from working in a garage to myself, I used to go out and do physical labor installing fences.
What's the average hours that you put into the fire station a week?
The average in the state of Oregon right now is 56 hours a week.
So that'd be 2 days
and
8 hours. 2 days.
24 hours on and 48 hours off. And out of this time, I would say that there is roughly 8 to 9% of the time that you are involved in atmospheres of smoke, toxic gases, superheated air, and this kind of thing. It's a very, very minute portion of the actual time. But it seems like a lot longer when you are involved in it.
Have you had a number of cases where you felt the decision as far as the fireman was concerned was unjust?
Yes, we have.
Could you bring that and show some of these cases as evidence to the committee? And do you have any with you?
I don't have any specific claim forms or anything on this. One in the city of Astoria, Herb Johnson had responded to an alarm of fire. He came back to the station, didn't feel well, went out to down on the front steps where the air was good and fresh, and that is where they found him.
Why don't you just present that to the committee so we have it available if you have these?
I can work up something on it.
Photostatic copy. We can make photostatic copies of the files there.
Yeah, actually, what notes I have there, I don't know whether anyone else could understand them or not. I could work up something.
If you do that, we'd appreciate it.
For you.
Are there any further questions? If not, thank you, Mr. Noble. Patrick, Mr. Flynn from Eugene.
Michael Flynn. I'm a retired firefighter. I'm a farmer outside of the city of Eugene. I'm a taxpayer in Eugene. I worked in the fire department for 25 years. I'm still a member of the Oregon State Firefighters Council. member of Local 851 and representing Local 851. Frank Jackson, President of the County Central Labor Council, asked me to be here today.
Why do you look so healthy with after 25 years of firefighting?
I spend most of my time firefighting, representing firefighters. Not everybody has an opportunity. If I may deviate from my statement, the question was about, from Senator Weir, about people exercising in the fire station and smoking. And I can't speak for all the firefighters in the state of Oregon, but I know in the city of Eugene, and Mr. Gary Long is here, and I guess he signed up to testify, and he can verify what I say. We spent an awful lot of money to buy exercise cycles, I guess they call them. And we had some people come out from the YMCA and a doctor check all of the firemen over and put them through a stress test, and they're all spending, I believe it's an hour a day or whatever it takes for them to get up to that heartbeat factor that they have to have individually, and they maintain it for, I think it's 15 minutes a day. And right now, people all over the country are becoming aware because of the incidence of heart conditions and lung problems in the fire service. They're becoming more cognizant of this. In fact, it's the business agent for the firefighters union in Eugene. When we built the new city hall, I specifically requested facilities to accommodate a physical fitness program. And at that time, it wasn't too well received tax-wise, and so it wasn't accepted. Subsequently, we've had a number of heart cases, and people are beginning to realize the benefit of this kind of a program. The firefighters in Eugene, and I don't speak for all firefighters over the country, and I deal with Mr. Noble. We might not live longer, but it may seem like it, but they have, on their own, recognize that smoking is a problem, people that I worked with that smoked for years no longer smoke. I haven't smoked a cigarette since 1952, if that helps any.
That's the reason. Do you smoke and keep up?
I'd like to.
He's a lot older now.
I think that,
and sex, wouldn't you agree that's good for your health? In opposition?
Well, I broke my neck in the fire department, and I had to go up to see a psychologist for the state industrial accident, and that was one of the questions he asked me, if I knew what sex was. My answer was that it was a natural phenomenon that I wasn't taking advantage of lately. And the gentleman called me in, and he spent 2 hours trying to find out what I meant by that, and I thought it was pretty well understood what I meant by it. But I don't know that it would. I think your question is self-explanatory. I don't think I have any more children in the fire service than that.
It's not Senator Weir, it's Senator Wires.
Wires, okay. Thank you.
Even though he is asking questions about sex, he's not Weir, he's Wires.
I'd like to mention about two cases. You talk about cases. By the way, I speaking here today, I'm not a firefighter anymore, and I don't have any vested interest in this particular thing. But I was a firefighter when this law was enacted. And I've been around, and I've watched the cases come up and the frustration that had been developed because of this law. We went to Senator at that time, Attorney General Thornton, and asked him for an opinion on the law on this disputable presumption, and his opinion at that time was the burden of proof was on the employer. And I'm not going to blame state action and insurance funds for all of the ills and problems and the litigation that's involved in this. I think it maybe would be easier to blame and point a finger at the employer. In this case, maybe the League of Oregon Cities, the League of Counties, and the cities themselves. And I have here Fortunately, an 801 form that was filled out by an injured workman that had a,
I need off his diagnosis if you want.
Mr. Toynak is a 52-year-old fireman who began having angina pectoris while fighting fires in the last year. As you know, he was admitted to the hospital with a myocardial infraction. A couple of issues seem clear. He does have coronary artery disease, and he had his first symptoms while fighting fire. The following issues do not seem clear. Is there a consistency and clear policy regarding the illness of coronary artery disease in the working man? Two, is there any method by which I can understand how some working men obtain coverage from SAFE for their coronary artery disease and others do not? And three, what are the solutions to this problem that have been employed in other states? For instance, I understand that all firemen and policemen who develop coronary artery disease while on the job are covered in the state of New York. Does this extend throughout the country? Has this issue been specifically discussed in our legislature? Has it been left in an ambiguous state on purpose? I would appreciate some background information before I make a scientific medical opinion in this case. This is signed by Dr. Maxwell. Now, the problem seems to me is pretty clear. Mr. Toynak, when you fill out an 801 form, he filled this out, and the city, he fills out the top section, the city fills out the second section. And this was a copy of this when he filled it out. Now, we received a copy of this 801 form after it was handed in to the city of Eugene to the fire department. And Mr. Richard Jones is administrative assistant to the fire chief. He knows Mr. Toynak personally. He filled this, left this all out and left section 59 blank. Section 59 says, if you doubt validity of claim, state the reason. Now this little section here is causing all the litigation and all the problems that we faced under the heart and lung bill. And we call it the heart and lung bill. I'd like to point out that my history of the last 15 years of helping our people with this particular law, I know of only one lung problem. The rest of them have all been heart. The one lung problem is a case of pneumonia that dealt with Mr. Fred N. O'Sullivan. The city of Eugene fought the case after it was won. They appealed it and appealed it. Finally got to that point in the law. It says that if they lose, they have to pay, I think it's 10 times the amount of the award. Interesting enough, Mr. O'Sullivan's award, I believe, was $80, and the city of Eugene had to pay $800. And so the amount of money that they saved the taxpayers by fighting this, and the litigation that they cost the taxpayer by forcing it through, seems to me to be lost. And as a taxpayer, I wonder just who we are protecting. Now to come back to the same form, Mr. Don Jones, who is the personnel officer who does not know Mr. Toynak, doesn't work in the fire department, knows nothing of the case, did not conduct any investigation whatsoever, filled this out. And to answer the 59, he writes a big no. But then he has a dash, and he says, question whether or not it is work-related, signed Don Jones. The State Industrial Accident Commission did question this because the employer has the right. I am a participating employer under SAIF, and I fill these things out. And I've been to seminars, and they tell you how to do this, and that's what to do if you want to question it. Mr. Jones did question it. So Mr. Toynak's case was denied subsequent. Mr. Toynak had two bypass. He had open heart surgery and two bypass arteries put in, and today he went back to work, and everybody is very happy about it. Everybody. That, I think, is what, when you talk about state industrial accident insurance is all about, is to rehabilitate, to get people back on the job, to keep them on the job, to check for the stresses and the injury-related committed misdemeanors on the job. And Mr. Kornack is back working. He's working today, and maybe I trust he'll work out the rest of his time, and the city of Eugene is happy. The only problem is that if he'd have been accepted under the claim, the state acting insurance fund would have contributed $500 and some a month to the city of Eugene for Mr. Kornack's employment. For his lost time payments. Mr. Kornack would not have used up all of his sick leave. And using up his sick leave, when he does retire, it will cost him money in the future. Mr. Kornack is picking up the tab for a whim on the part of Mr. Jones, who doesn't even know. And this is not uncommon. Mr. Novin mentioned the Hugo Johnson case in Astoria. Fortunately, we were able to recover on that, and Mrs. Johnson did get retroactive pay. But he mentioned the case in Redford, James Minnis' case. Mr. Minnis deceased, died, and Mrs. Minnis was denied any consideration on his claim. It was appealed, and upon appeal, to the old workman's comp board, he received retroactive pay and was given a compensation for a period of time. She subsequently got married and got off of it. But we have every one of these cases that we have under hard cases right now is being challenged under the law, the way the law is presently written. And I would think that 701, it won't answer all of the things, and it doesn't close all the loopholes, and there is such an area if there's excessive smoking or some other problem that the doctor can handle this case. But what the law specifically deals with is that firefighter who, having came on the job and having taken an examination, it shows no heart or lung condition whatsoever, and then worked there for 5 years and develops it. And I would stress this. I was a firefighter for 27 years. I don't think, now we all talk about smoke and smoke inhalation and a lot of the gases, and these are very important. But the sad part of the thing that I don't think is stressed quite enough is that if you had the most healthy, young track star in the world, you had him sitting in this room, and he was asked, when the bell rang or when the gun went off, to run a 100-yard dash, and he did it. He would do it about 3 times, and he'd have poor hamstring muscles, and he'd have every other kind of a problem, plus he'd be a nervous wreck. And that's what you're asking a firefighter to do. You're sitting in an area that could be, maybe he's on his unicycle or his bicycle, or maybe he's doing something else, but he's completely relaxed. And pretty soon the alarm rings, and the hypertension, and pretty soon after this, he gets conditioned to it, and he's sitting there waiting. And I know myself, that in the latter years, and I'm maybe the easiest man to go to sleep that anybody in this room has ever seen. In the latter years, I didn't get to sleep in a fire station until 3 o'clock in the morning, and 4 o'clock, because you just couldn't go to sleep. And this is the type of thing that causes the stress, that causes this heart condition. And it isn't just for Oregon, it's all over the United States. And I think that the committee should be made aware of that particular part of it. And there's nothing you can do to resolve that. If you're going to have people on duty 24 hours a day, and if you're going to turn them out on alarm, it's there. Part of the job, and it does contribute, and it's the fact that we have so many cases. You asked about having these cases documented. We've got so many cases, we've got more cases in the Court of Appeals than I care to mention.
I think you said that the tension causes heart problems. You work 48 hours and you're off, what? 50? You work 48 hours and you're off 56 or off?
I'm a farmer now, and I went 24 hours every day. When I was a firefighter, it was 24 on and 48 off.
Okay, 24 on and 48 off?
Yeah.
Okay. That, if you take that 48 hours off and just relax around the house, putter around the yard, and if you didn't take another job, wouldn't you be in better condition? I mean, if you get a little exercise around the yard, maybe spading or transplanting shrubs or, working around the yard and... Why go out and bicycle or go swimming or boating or fishing or whatever, but you could relax for 2 days. You got 24 hours, 48 off, 24, 48 off. You have about 3 or 4 days a week you could do it. Most of us only have two. I don't even have 2 days a week that I could, hardly that I can do what I really want to do.
Well, thank you. I agree with you. It sounds good. But I worked with a unique firefighter, and I didn't work on my day off, believe it or not. I coached wrestling at St. Francis High School. I did a lot of things. I helped people for the American Red Cross all over the state, from Eugene to Portland for radiology treatment for cancer and a number of things like that. I kept pretty busy, and I kept in pretty good shape up until the last few years. But interesting enough, I don't, and I'm going to respectfully disagree with you. You can be relaxed the day off. That's no problem. But when you come on, at 2 minutes after 8 o'clock in the morning, you're subject to respond to that bell. And your back is, you took a, put a rat in a maze, and have that bell ring, and then give them a shock, and this is what you're doing. And pretty soon, if you don't have a frustrated you're kidding yourself. And that's exactly what to do with that firefighter. I think that hypertension is there, and it does develop, and Mr. Kornack is a unique case. This man never smoked in his life. He's 52 years of age. He was a health food fattest, I'll tell you. He checked his cholesterol or anything else. And good golfer. He didn't work on his days off, but he played golf. He bowled. He was a top bowler in a number of things. And the man had this blockage in the artery. Two of them, and he had a bypass operation. And we're happy to say he's better. He's going to live a very long, productive life, we hope. But it was denied because of the challenge on Box 59. I have the evidence here. And I would think that this is the type of thing that we would like to eliminate. We don't even personally, if you're really going to do something with firemen, you'd do away with the disputable presumption entirely. You just make it conclusively presumed. But we don't feel that that's absolutely necessary. What we want to do is point out that if it costs from other sources, then it costs from other sources. If it costs from the fire service, then it should be considered. And that's what it's all about.
Yes, Senator Crow.
Yeah. With regard to the section you're adding, to the statute, the denial of a claim and so forth, and you say must be on the basis of conclusive medical evidence that the cause and so forth. The conclusive, I wonder if you need it. How about just on the basis of medical evidence?
Well, I didn't write the amendment.
No.
If I had written the amendment, Senator, I think I would have been happy with just striking, going up in the further section and just striking the disputable entirely. In this case, I'll be presumed to have. And the presumption then would have been loose enough that if it... But on the language down below, I think that what we're dealing with, and I can read a letter, the doctors don't quite understand the law. They don't understand that, okay, here's a law that applies to firefighters. Why doesn't it apply to me? We used to have an attorney out of the Attorney General's office that worked for the old SIAC. His name was Lasky. And he had a heart condition, and he worked in the office. And he came in, and I walked in and talked to him. He says, well, Pat, he said, I got a heart condition. Why am I covered under the law? He said, you're covered, and I'm not.
Now, I see what you're saying, and my question only has to do with the language here. The disputably presumed is in the existing language. The language that you're putting in, which modifies that, is this conclusive medical evidence. And I'm not an attorney, so I don't know what conclusive medical evidence means. It says must be on the basis of medical, it seems to me, medical evidence. Makes as much sense. So maybe Jan can help us. Is the conclusive needed there?
Well, the conclusive just makes it a lot stronger.
Makes it a little stronger.
Puts the burden, a lot heavier burden on the employer to...
Are there any further questions? If not, thank you, Pat. Dave Krieger with Oregon Trial Attorneys.
Yeah, there you go. Now we know.
Mr. Chairman,
Albany representing trial lawyers. The problem we have with the existing statute is one of interpretation as to what the legislature meant when they had a disputable presumption in the existing law. There isn't any other section in the workman's compensation law that has a disputable presumption in it, and therefore I have to assume that the legislature meant that the fireman should have one leg up, so to speak. What has happened is that in a particular case in the Court of Appeals, it's called the Food Hop case, which I can get a copy of if you so desire. The Court of Appeals really annihilated any presumption whatsoever in regard to firemen. It basically said that a fireman must come forth initially with evidence from a doctor that his heart condition or lung condition was caused by his employment as a fireman. If he didn't do that, the presumption doesn't even apply. Well, that in effect says that there isn't any presumption at all, because that's what you have to do in any kind of a heart case or any kind of a lung case, any kind of a compensation case. So the court really annihilated it, and the intent, as I see it, in this amendment, or this bill, is to put some teeth into the presumption that was granted to the firemen years ago. The language that you have in the present bill is clear that the workman does not have to come forth with a medical opinion that his heart condition is related. It is presumed. But if there is other evidence from the carrier standpoint, such as in regard to Senator Wire's question, in regard to smoking, excessive weight, lack of exercise, history of heart condition in your family, all of which are factors that lead up to a heart problem. If those exist, then the doctor can say, yes, even though this man was a fireman, all these other factors would tell us that those are more material to the onset of the heart condition than his being a fireman. Therefore, the presumption would not apply. So what you're talking about here is a matter of legal procedure. Who has to come forth first with the medical evidence? If this bill is passed, the workman, fireman, would not have to come forth with any medical evidence. It would be up to the carrier employer to come forth with evidence to show that it was not related, and these other factors would be considered. The way it is now, the presumption has no meaning whatsoever as far as the fireman is concerned. It just is non-existent because of that decision. And if you, as we discussed a minute ago, if you remove from the existing law the word disputable and leave in the word presumption, it may have an effect. I don't know what the courts would do with it, but I'm afraid that unless you clarify it as this bill does, we're going to be back where we started. So I would urge that you pass this. You can get into a medical discussion or philosophical discussion as to whether or not the workman fireman should have a presumption. I don't intend to discuss that, but if you do, which I believe the legislature did with this existing law, then it should be clarified so that it has some meaning for these firemen, because right now it has no meaning.
Yes, sir.
Now, how long has the existing law been in effect? You know, honestly, I can't tell you.
61. Passed it, so I imagine.
So when was the Flughoff decision?
Just in the last year.
Last year. Before that decision, had presumption, the disputable presumption, worked pretty much in favor of the firemen?
As far as I know, there had not been any decisions at the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court level regarding this particular bill. It had not worked in favor of the fireman in the sense that he still had to come forth with medical evidence. No, it had not worked in favor of the fireman. The these cases that were cited to you by Mr. Noble, for example, each and every one of those cases were defeated because the workman did not come forth initially with a medical opinion that his heart or lung condition was caused by his work as a fireman, which you have to do in every compensation. Therefore, the claim was defeated. Therefore, the presumption did not apply.
So the Fluhoff case hasn't made that much difference.
Well, it's definitely, you could argue before, you see, you could argue in front of the referee or board or whatever, that this is what I think the presumption meant. And there wasn't any authority one way or the other. But now, there is a definitive case that says it really doesn't exist. So there isn't any chance now for a fireman to come in unless he has a medical opinion that says it's related to when his case. There's no sense even trying now. Whereas before you could try because there wasn't any decision.
What this is doing is really putting teeth into the disputable presumption, which hadn't had really any teeth before.
Correct.
Period.
Ever. That's right.
Okay.
Dave, Fiscal announced that this bill was the budget management analyst was Beth Barnes, and she says in here, the state accident insurance fund estimates that there could be considerable litigation to determine what constitutes conclusive medical evidence, increasing court costs. Do you have any comment on that?
I don't think you're going to have any more litigation now. In fact, you'll have less than you have now. The word conclusive, as Senator Weyer says, there isn't any real definitive meaning to that. It does say that you must have more evidence than if you didn't have the word conclusive. But what would happen if this bill were passed as amended would be that the fireman who has a heart attack would file a claim. It would be presumed under the law that that resulted from his work as a fireman. Now, if the employer questioned that,
otherwise.
And must prove it otherwise, if the employer or SAFE questions that, they would go to a physician, either the workman's physician or their own, with the individual set of facts pertaining to that claim. If that doctor or doctors felt that there were other factors that were more determinative in the heart condition other than the work, he would say so. They would then have evidence to rebut that presumption. They would then deny the claim. You would then have a hearing as you would in the claims now, and you would be right back to where you were as far as the litigation. I don't think you're going to have more litigation. I think you're going to have less, because you have a presumption that the fireman can work with.
The problem is that there are some doctors that, and I think you're aware, probably aware of this, that you can generally find the right answer from, at least some attorneys are able to do that.
Well, very definitely. There are certain doctors that have philosophical bents in regard to medicine as to what causes what. That's true, no question about it.
Both ways.
Both ways. Yeah.
Right, and you can make lists on both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Are you saying the employer can go to any doctor and just present that doctor certain facts about the individual? Let's say he's 20 pounds overweight and he smokes a lot and he's had a heart attack, and just ask any doctor, or do you have to go to the doctor that's the attending physician of the person?
No, you can go to any doctor.
Anybody
go to any doctor right now today.
And just say, here's the facts about Mr. X, and you've never examined, but he's done these things, therefore will you certify that these things would indicate that he's not entitled to this?
That's correct. You go to the doctor with a hypothetical question that has all the variables in it, and the doctor will then give his opinion based upon those hypothetical facts, and they can present that, and that's the way it works now. You can go to any doctor.
Senator Weyers?
One fairly short question. Senator Crow just asked you if this disputable presumption, if we weren't going to be improving the situation, I'm changing the words, but tell me if I say this wrong. The line of questioning that you went through with him ended up with this disputable presumption never having helped the fireman much, because before the Flughoff case, that question hadn't gotten to very much. Isn't that what you meant?
Correct.
But didn't the Flughoff case
almost deleted this language, this disputable presumption, right?
Right.
So, but the point that happened wasn't from the injured, the fireman with a heart or lung problems point of view, wasn't the law weakened for him, even though he hadn't been, individual fireman hadn't been getting much use out of it before. It still weakened the law to have the Bushop case come.
Oh, no question about that. Yeah. None whatsoever, because you could go in front of a referee or a circuit court, as Judge Hay has cited by Mr. Noble, and that particular referee or judge could say, yes, the legislature did mean that there was a presumption, and the carrier must overcome that. And the individual fireman could have won in that particular situation, but not
some of firemen may have won that we don't know about because it never got to the Court of Appeals to be decided.
That's correct.
Very definitely. Wouldn't it almost be fair to presume that at least one has sometimes?
Oh, I'm sure there is. In fact, I can give you cases where they have. But
might have even settled very early before it even got to the circuit court, but that had, went into the board's thinking, for example.
That's right.
Yeah.
Very definitely.
Mr. Private,
Senator Cope.
Basically, then, let's say that this does happen. You've got a borderline person who does smoke and is overweight and does have a heart attack. And so the employer goes out and gets that information certified by a doctor. The attorney representing the employee probably goes to the employee's doctor. What do you have? Do you have the board making a decision, or the courts making a decision as to which medical evidence then is conclusive? Is that?
Well, your referee at your hearing will decide that initially.
Yeah.
As to, under the facts, which is the more persuasive medical evidence.
Yeah.
He makes the initial decision. Then if that is disagreed with by either party, then it is appealed to the board now.
Yeah.
Then to the circuit court. Then to the Court of Appeals.
We might have more litigation.
Very well may have.
Senator Turnstead.
But it has to be more conclusive. It would have to be conclusive evidence. It wouldn't have to be more evidence. If you had an argument on both sides, the wording of this would weight it in favor of the fireman. I'm not saying this is wrong or right, but this would weight it, the argument, in favor of the fireman.
Well, I'm not very honest with you, Senator. I'm not sure what that word conclusive would do, to be very frank.
Then why do you want it?
I didn't write that amendment.
Oh.
I don't know. I didn't put that word in there.
Do you have a better word?
No. Frankly, I haven't thought about it.
The way it's on the other day.
Pardon me?
What word could we use there that would determine which way would determine which way the court or the hearing officer or whatever determination is taking? Is there some other verbiage that we could use in this? Preponderance of evidence? Does that sound right? What about preponderance of evidence?
Well, the trouble with the preponderance of evidence, Senator, is that means that there has been a disagreement already as to the medical evidence and which one is the more persuasive.
What about substantial?
Substantial would be better.
Okay.
I frankly hadn't thought about that, and I think it should be given some thought before any other word is put in. The basic idea of the bill is that the fireman does not have to have any medical evidence. It has to be presumed to have. Then the carrier has to have medical evidence to overcome the presumption. I'd have to think about that. I'm not sure about that word conclusive.
Let's consider that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Wires? Is there... if there was some way to say that the Flugelhoff case were overturned and that the language would otherwise remain the same, would that be a better way to go?
I really don't think so.
But isn't that really the intent of this bill? Is to get the advantage of the language that the firemen already have that they can't get here today?
The problem with just specifically repealing or overturning Flugelhoff through legislation is that the court went through the definitions of disputable presumption. And they define how disputable presumption applies in the law, not only in this particular instance. And I cannot disagree with their result. And therefore, if you just say that is repealed and still leave in disputable presumption, that is not going to solve the problem.
because the legal definition of disputable presumption is still in the law. So
we have three more witnesses and we have three more bills. I don't know how long we're going to hold on to you, Jan. We have another committee meeting at 3?
Yeah.
So we'd be lack of a quorum, and I hope we can. We have Steve Telfer.
Maybe Wendy.
As in opposition to the bill, as well as Gary Long and Betty Collins. They're from the city. Do you want to come up here at once, all three of you? Would you like to? And you can each give your testimony, and if there are any questions, we can address them to any one of you. Or you can add to you can add to Steve's testimony if you wish.
What about him to do it again?
I know. It makes it rough.
I know.
So what are the passing chairs?
Oh,
just pull one over there. I'm sorry. Attaboy.
Pull over.
Here we are.
Hey, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, the members of the committee, for the record, I'm Steve Telfer. I'm appearing today on behalf of the League of Oregon Cities. Rather than reading my testimony for the sake of time, I will just attempt to comment on what our position is. The League Legislative Committee is in opposition to this bill in its present form, and basically on the theory that the switch to denial only on the basis of conclusive medical evidence that the cause or condition of the impairment is unrelated to the firefighter's employment simply shifts the burden entirely to the point where it would be almost impossible ever to deny a claim.
Steve, you heard the previous witness testimony, Dave Krigers, and he is willing to change that word and thought that maybe substantial, whichever way the evidence weighed. Would you accept that?
Well, I'll tell you what I have suggested. I have the gal handing out some amendments to the bill. In fact, I've taken the liberty of hand engrossing it to do what we think would be more acceptable, and frankly, that would retain the disputable presumption that's in the law now, and would provide for employer-paid physical examinations, and then would, in essence, say that if the physical exam uncovered what's known as a predisposing condition, and the firefighter failed to, if he was able to correct that, it would make him ineligible for coverage. Now, this is patterned after the Nevada statutes, and we feel would be very, very much more acceptable, and frankly, to make it short and simple, we would very much appreciate sitting down with the firefighters and any subcommittee you'd like to appoint, Mr. Chairman, and attempt to work at this problem.
Okay.
Why don't you do your usual and have them time it out?
No, I would like to hear. Do you have anything further to add to this? Betty Collins?
Yeah. I just want to say that we buried my mother-in-law yesterday with a heart and lung complication. She never smoked or fought a fire in her life. I've had a heart attack and renal surgery, and I've neither fought a fire. I must admit I do smoke. I'm 47 years old, and I'm not putting any claims. I suggest that if you're going to continue covering every fireman that has a heart attack, maybe you ought to cover motherhood and apple pie, too.
Do you have any further to add to it, Gary?
Yes, I submitted a written statement from the City of Eugene, and I guess the things that I would like to emphasize in that are, one, that the shifting of burdens would would, in fact, significantly or would make it impossible for us to defend against such a claim. And given the state of the science about with the causes and risk factors about heart disease, we think that that's an unreasonable burden to place on the employer. I'd like to emphasize and point the committee to the problem City of Eugene is having at the present time. We've had 10 claims filed in the last few years, and the implications of that for a single employer, even though we employ 800-900 employees, the implications of that in dollars has direct public safety service results, and they are negative. Our premiums have gone from $115,000 in 1972-73 to $400,000 today, and are projected to go way beyond that in the next fiscal year. So it's a matter of concern to us. We think that the committee ought to retain the same standard of preponderance of evidence that applies to any workman's comp claim, and apply that same standard to a heart claim. I could go into some of the particulars of the Trinac case, which was brought up here today, and I would just summarize it by simply saying there are other issues in that case that were not presented by Mr. Flynn. But I would emphasize that despite the fact that the Trinac case was denied, Mr. Trinac's medical costs and his wages lost were covered through insurance programs provided through his employment. So he's not left high and dry. He has alternatives.
Steve, do you have anything further to add? Or?
Well, I don't think so, Senator, other than, again, to stress that we'd be pleased to sit down.
Steve, you're here all the time. Why don't you work with the firefighters? And I've been having there, taking a look at your amendment now, which doesn't seem to be too shabby.
Thank you.
And, Senator Turnstedt, would you like to work with him and on a, just work with him on a subcommittee of one?
Sure.
Okay. See if we can iron it out.
There's nothing further. 701, this would conclude the hearing.
And we'll go to Senate Bill 1030.
Came to demonstrate a vacuum cleaner. He informed me that the vacuum cleaner was more than simply a vacuum cleaner, that it would act as an air purification system for the entire house, taking all the dust out of the air. It would also perform many amazing feats. The cost of this vacuum cleaner, $440. We purchased it on a referral sale program, by which we would get $5 for everyone that we could find to buy a vacuum cleaner, if they bought it or not. We would get the $5 on our sale card for the vacuum cleaner. It soon became apparent that the vacuum cleaner involved was nowhere near what it had been, what it should be. It did not purify the air or did not do anything else. It did not even vacuum the rug. We are involved in a court battle in this matter for nearly a year now, in which we have been defending an action brought by the sailor. This case is still pending.
I'd like to point out that if there were a $200 minimum damage provision, so forth, definitely be a deterrent to making of the representations in cases such as this one. And Mr. Fulbert can address himself to that briefly later.
Other questions
in
the committee members?
Well, I would like to have get back to Mr. Johnson. Would you point out the specific cause here that would have covered his particular action here when he bought his car? Which one would you have prosecuted under?
Well, misrepresenting representing the goods were original and new. They told Mr. Johnson that his engine was rebuilt when it wasn't. They told him that it was in good condition. There were several things that are, you know, that are actually covered under the existing law, and some things that are a little hazy under the existing law, which would be, I think, brought into focus by some of the broader language here.
That's what I was getting back, why couldn't you have done it under the present law? Because it looked to me like the same things that were covered in the law that's now on the books.
It's true, but the criminal or the enforcement of the state,
the enforcement of the
of law is just non-existent right now. As Mr. Shannon has said, the only person in four counties is enforcing this law, and automobile dealers such as Mr. Johnson Dublin can make these representations almost with impunity.
Did anyone go to the district attorney and ask him? He was the one that was charged with enforcing it.
I'm sure we wrote or sent something over there.
Question to Mr.
typical of virtually hundreds experience with, and which I'm sure Mr. Shannon has too. And that even though in some of the cases they've had a legal aid attorney, they've been victorious in a lawsuit, they've had to go through an awful lot before that happens. And if they weren't eligible for legal aid, they would have to pay a lot of money for legal advice to get out of it. That's all.
Before I make a statement, if I could, I'd like to answer Senator McPherson's question a little further about...
Your full name and whether or not you're representing someone or your address or something like that.
Certainly. My name is Jay Fulberg, and I'm a supervising attorney at the Albina Legal Aid Office. I'm not here to represent any one person. F-O-L-B-E-R-G. Senator McPherson, I did represent Solomon Johnson after he came into legal aid. Previous to seeing us, Solomon Johnson had visited with two private attorneys, neither one of whom was willing to take his case. Upon hearing of Solomon Johnson's story involving the car that he told you of, we sent him to still a third attorney. That attorney refused to take his case, and I talked to that attorney. I can represent that the attorney indicated to me that he felt that there would be a good chance to rescind the contract that Solomon Johnson had. He saw no opportunity for any punitive damages or any other recovery other than to get Solomon Johnson's money back. There was no provision at that time for attorney fees in the case. At the time Mr. Johnson went to see this attorney, he had had some economic hardships, he was unemployed, and the attorney did not want to put himself in position of recovering his fees from the money that Solomon Johnson, he felt, rightfully had coming back to him, and thus he refused to take the case, because there would be no attorney fees for him, unless it came out of the very meager assets at that time, Mr. Johnson. The provision of this bill, which would allow for attorney fees, would certainly cover that point, and I think that's a good example of a case that legal aid could have had a private attorney handle had this bill then been enacted in effect. Further, there were problems with proof as to the personal injuries, but that really wasn't a significant consideration of the attorney. Also, as to whether or not the matter had been referred to Mr. Shannon, as we understood the existing law, all that Mr. Shannon could do was stop this practice in the future. It wouldn't help Mr. Johnson at all. And Mr. Johnson was concerned about others being taken by the same dealer. But his principal concern was getting back those much-needed assets because he couldn't afford another car until this matter had been taken care of. So the existing law just wasn't adequate at all to cover the problem. And this law, if it passed, if this became law, it would cover that problem. It was not unfair. A significant amount of the work done by legal aid service on behalf of poor people is done in the area of consumer problems. We've dealt with roughly 1,000 consumer complaints ourselves over the last year. In addition, Legal Aid Service acts as a lawyer referral service for the Multnomah County Bar. We refer people to private attorneys if they're over the economic income guidelines established by the federal government for our services, or if the case that they have might generate a fee for private attorneys. I talk to a lot of attorneys on the phone in attempting to refer these cases, as do others in our offices, and the attorneys are generally quite interested in these consumer problems, but generally they won't take the case, primarily because there's just no fee in it. And they're usually dealing with people who have had economic hardship because of the action of a seller. And the attorney often doesn't want to put himself in the position of charging a fee of a relatively poor person, particularly when the result is very uncertain in the present law. In addition, the attorneys on the other side of these cases, who represent the sellers and the collection companies, are very expert in the area in which they deal. They deal repetitively in that area, and the attorneys to whom we refer these cases are aware of that. So when that's combined with the likelihood of no fee and an improbable result in the case, it's very difficult for us to refer any of the consumer cases out that we get in. Most
to the actions and the cases in the consumer area that come into the legal aid service are in the context of a person who's being sued by a seller of merchandise or the collection company to which the seller has assigned the note or assigned the papers. As the current law exists, we're not in a very good position to raise a counterclaim in those cases. And the most that we can usually do, even though the goods and services are often not as promised, is negotiate in behalf of the purchaser, our client, the consumer. And we rarely are able to obtain full satisfaction. The consumer usually ends up paying something, even though the goods and merchandise were not as promised. In those rare actions, when a consumer comes in before he's being sued and says they'd like to do something because they feel they've been taken by a consumer, the amounts involved are usually very small, $10, $15, $20, that he's actually been damaged. Even though legal aid service doesn't charge a fee, we still have to look at the economics of the court system and the economics of the utilization of our time because there are more demands made upon us than we can satisfy. And it's just not practical for a private attorney, nor a legal aid attorney, to handle a case for $10, $15, or $20. We do it on occasion. But the class action provision of the bill certainly helps make the use of not only the lawyer's time, but the use of the court facility much more economic and much better use of taxpayers' resources. The problem that we see in telling clients who come into us, particularly those clients who are just marginally over our income guidelines, so we can't help them. But I'm sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. No private attorney will handle your case. It's too small. Legal aid service can't take it because you're over our income guidelines. Or even if you're under the income guidelines, we still might not be able to take it. The most we can do is try to clear you if they sue you. There's a very high level of frustration and malcontent, and I'm sure we've all felt ourselves. In knowing that a matter doesn't merit a great deal of our time, and yet you know that someone has taken unfair advantage of you, and there's virtually no legal remedy. And that exists quite frequently. Therefore, in summary, I think that the provisions I would most like to address myself to are those that provide a $200 minimum damages, which would make the cases more attractive to the clients for sure. For instance, in Mr. Johnson's case, he did get his money back for the cost, but I can assure you that he had to spend hours and hours in my office in the courts waiting, and he received no compensation for his time. And it's so rarely that a person is able to go against a dealer in that regard that it's not really much of a hardship for a dealer, and that would help. In addition, the provision for attorney's fees would allow legal aid service to refer a great number of cases that we're now unable to find any lawyer to handle, and legal aid service very often can't handle those cases either. And finally, the class action aspect of this bill would make it much more practical for legal aid service to try to do something significant where a large number of people come in. And, for instance, in one vacuum cleaner company, have had more than 20 people come in to see us or have been referred to us, who have all been taken by the same scheme. And we just don't have the resources generally to bring 20 cases when the relative amounts are small. I'd like just to end with one example. I represented a fellow who had very severe economic hardships occur. He became unemployed because of an injury. He wasn't able to get employment. He had problems. He was kicked out of the apartment he lived in because he couldn't pay the rent. We had to negotiate with utility companies because he couldn't pay his bills. We finally thought we got things more or less resolved, and he had joined the program which was trying to train him for a new job. And he called me, and he wanted me to know that he thought his economic problems were over with, because he just bought a vacuum cleaner. And one of the benefits of buying this vacuum cleaner was that he would get $10 for each person he referred to this vacuum cleaner company. And with all of his friends, he knew that this would soon get him out of the hole economically. And of course, we knew from our past experience that it's mathematically impossible, or virtually impossible, for him to come anywhere close to paying for the vacuum cleaner referral at $10 each, which was over a $400 machine, yet alone help himself out of the hole. And the person who sold him the machine was very much aware of his economic situation, and that was with the big sales pitch. I know you're poor. I know you don't have any money, but I'm going to help you out. And I think this bill will certainly cover the referral sales teams that Mr. Shannon and Legal Aid see so much of in the way of hardship.
Questions, Mr. Colburn? This concludes the testimony that people have indicated they want to testify. Is there anyone else here who would like to make a statement?
Betty?
Yes.
I just wanted to submit a statement. I want to read it. It's just a summary of the position that Demo Form holds.
Would you state your name and who you're representing?
Betty, of course. Representing Demo Form. We've been working on some consumers.
And you're submitting a statement from them?
Yes, and I'd like
to. All right, fine. Mr. Moore, did we get you identified properly?
Ernie Moore from the Department of Commerce, and I've been working with our panel in the consumer complaint problem with the government's consumer affairs task force. And I just wanted to go on record that we feel that it's very high.
Is this the Department of Commerce in favor of this, or is this the executive?
The Office of Consumer Protection.
The Office of Consumer Protection.
real estate to indicate on the instrument whether or not road access is available to the property, and if not, an indication that there is no road access to the property. This is some question, a problem that is raised quite often to county governments. A person will purchase a piece of property and not be aware of the physical layout, and after obtaining the property, find that they have no access to the property, and then of course come to the county and seek some type of road into their property. And we would ask that this committee for their consideration in introducing this as a bill of the Consumer Affairs Committee.
Yes, I'd like to ask a question. I wondered if your bill goes far enough. I think it's a far bigger problem than just no access and improper access. I think we've run into problems much down in our county with roads that are not really roads. They're appear to be roads, but they're not legal roads, and the county therefore cannot take them over. Is there any effort in this bill to also notify the people that perhaps the road that appears to be a road is not a legal road and therefore will be maintained by the...
Yes, we haven't gone this far, and there is this distinction between a public road and what is actually a adopted county road, which the county has the requirement to maintain and upkeep. However, the statute provides that they cannot expend revenues on public roads that aren't a part of the system. We felt that this would be an initial step when this gets to committee, if it is the committee's desire. I think this would be most appropriate to identify whether this is a public road or whether it is a county road or a state road or a city street that services a particular property. And of course there are varying indications then as to the degree of maintenance that will be provided on that road.